Welcome once again to Core Ideas, a paleolimnology podcast where we delve into all things lake sediments. As always, we are your hosts, myself, Adam Jaziorski.
And Josh Theenpont. Thanks for coming back once again.
And today, we're talking about joining the Illuminati, at least from a paleolimnology perspective.
From a distance.
And what we're getting at today is really the whole role of scientific societies and meetings and associations and the importance of these groups and events to, I guess, in a very general sense, but then also to paleolimnologists in particular.
Yeah, so less secret meetings and black robes and dungeon layers, but a very important part of the way in which science is done historically, and I think still fairly relevant in the modern scientific environment, though different than maybe historically they have been.
Yeah, and so just to give a little bit of background, when we talk about historically, it being like one of the first questions is why would these societies be formed in the first place? And basically, I think a lot of the idea was just groups of like-minded people getting together to pursue things that they were interested in. If you're talking about learned societies in general, the oldest ones are not necessarily scientific ones, but historically we're going to, you know, use the Royal Society of the United Kingdom as a starting point. So that would have been founded in 1660.
That was a long time ago. My goodness.
Yeah.
They would have been wearing robes and meeting in the basement and play.
Yeah, well, it's powdered wigs time.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. With some pretty illustrious presidents over that intervening 400 years almost.
Yeah, well, I remember as a kid growing up in England, I don't remember which note Newton would have been on. It might have been the 50-pound note. I'd have to double check that up. Mm-hmm. But I remember, you know, it wasn't one I saw very often, but I definitely yeah. remembered of him as the guy with the really awesome hair.
Right, yeah.
And it was a little bit of a, you know, crushing blow when I realized, no, he probably had a shaved head and that was just a wig.
Well, you could always hope.
Due to the fleas.
Yeah, no kidding. Among other things. but in general, the idea being that the society, the Royal Society, originally as a way of getting together, bringing scientific discussion to sort of out of the university settings to have academics from all different areas come together, either physically or in writing, to promote excellence in science and benefit humanity, which is their official statement.
Yes, or like their, I don't know, it's
raison d'etre.
Raison d'etre, their aspirational statement that they greet you with on their landing page. And then Royal Society was followed by other national societies. And of course, we have a strong bias to Canada, and which it was formed in 1882, so much later, but in many ways patterned over the original Royal Society. Although I believe it has a broader scope where it includes the arts as well, whereas
as different
the Royal Society different groups, of London yeah. is... you know, purely science. Mm-hmm.
And well, at some point, I'm sure we'll get him on the podcast, John Small, who's was our PhD supervisor and Adam's boss at the moment, is the president of the Academy of Sciences within the Royal Society of Canada currently. So that's something we could discuss with him because that's a fairly new role. I haven't seen him a great deal since he took on that role personally. So that would be something that we could always get his opinion on from the inside.
Yeah, no, definitely something to ask him about down the road.
And then moving beyond the national society level where all different sciences, whether they be astronomy or chemistry or biology or any other discipline, was kept together at the national level, at the country level, there's a push for different scientific disciplines to identify and come together as a group. in order to probably have a little bit more common discussion in that way. You're going to get a lot more similarities in what you're talking about if it's all chemists who come together as opposed to some people from all different disciplines. And therefore, from a paleolimnology perspective, for the Core Ideas podcast, the discipline or the society that we would most strongly align with would be the International Paleolimnology Association.
And I think we'll get into this a little bit more later on. But, you know, even within that one association, the level or the breadth of interest is incredibly broad. And, but there are also many other societies that would be potentially of interest to a, you know, a new paleolimnologist. And then within North America, like, again, showing our own biases and our own affiliations, some of the key ones would be the Society of Canadian Limnologists, so broadening out to limnology in general as opposed to just paleolimnology, and then, which is a, I guess, a daughter association of the Society of International Limnology?
It is the Canadian branch of that. It's not a formal, we'll talk about this a little later on because I'm on the executive of SCL. It's no longer a formal connection because we've incorporated as a society, but it is still has that historical tie. And some others that we commonly and that paleolimnologists would find themselves visiting or presenting at their meetings or being members of would be things like the Canadian Conference for Fisheries Research, which is actually a meeting, not a society in the same way, but it does have a similar sort of mandate and ideas behind it. The North American Lake Management Society, NALMS. The international, what's IAGLER stand for? The
spot here.
International Furious Association Googling of Great Lakes Research, I believe. and then there are lots of others, some that are specific to the indicator that you're studying. So it might be related to the benthos or diatoms or cladocerans. Some related to the time period that you're interested in. So in a Canadian context, we have the Canadian Quaternary Association. So people studying lake changes over the last 2 million years would fall within that. There's an International Quaternary Association. There's a all different associations that are temporally constrained in that framework. There are pollen-specific societies. There's just a plethora of different groupings of academics, and many people belong to many of these scientific societies.
Yeah, and various subsets. Like basically, I think the number of people out there that are members of all of the societies that we have listed would be virtually zero. There's going to be some picking and choosing depending on what your particular interests are and what your expertise is and where you're based regionally. And yeah, and so it's all going to be very, very specific, but a key thing at the beginning stages of graduate studies is learning what is out there.
Yeah, for sure. And it's also the case probably that some people's membership in these societies sort of waxes and wanes. It's not ideal. So, you know, the idea would be you would stick to a society, you would continue to pay your membership dues if there are such things, or continue to renew your membership. But other times, you know, there's a lot of them and that can add up quite quickly. So perhaps your research you're working on now is more focused on connections to modern day limnology. So you're a member of SCL, whereas in the future, you may revert to doing more pollen-based work, or you identify as a geographer more specifically because you changed departments and you want to go to the Association of American Geographers meeting. So you join AAG. Or AGU or any of those different societies. So there's lots of potential for being a member of different societies at different time periods. And I agree, no one maintains membership in 30 different societies. That would be cost prohibitive. Your email would probably explode from all of the lists you'd be on, and not really the point of the societies.
Okay, so having listed off a whole bunch of societies, but a far from exhaustive list that would be potentially relevant to a paleolimnologist within North America. In addition to the differences in like sub-disciplines and indicators and those kind of things, there are also a breadth of differences of purposes behind these societies or meetings or conferences or associations. And it comes down, on very broad strokes, is their principal interest advocacy, bringing benefits to all of humanity, versus the production of a journal. So a lot of societies are associated with a specific journal and has a journal of the society.
One or more than one in some cases for the big ones, yeah.
Yeah, so like the Royal Society we mentioned earlier would have...
looked it up, has 9 journals associated with them. Some of them newer and kind of online open access ones, but some of them that have been published for hundreds of years.
Yeah. ASLO, so the American Society of Limnology and Oceanography, their journal.
I think, didn't they change their name so it's not American anymore? I think I don't even remember what it is. It's not American anymore, but it is the same acronym.
Yep. No, you're right. I do remember that as being it's probably not that recent, but in my brain, that's still...
Of course.
It's one of those things you don't say the acronym in full very often, so it's in there.
It's the Skydome example for our Canadian listeners.
Rogers Centre. Air Canada Centre.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, come on. I'm totally lost my track of thought here.
ASLO, whatever that stands for. It's still Limnology and Oceanography, primarily with a North American perspective, but also taking in the international audience, produces Limnology and Oceanography, the journal, and also, I believe, L&O Letters, which is a second journal that's more recent to them. We mentioned SIL, the Society of International Limnology, which is the international community of limnologists that SEL, the Canadian subgroup, is part of, at least tangentially. They produce Inland Waters as their society journal.
The Royal Society of Canada produces the journal Facets.
I think this is maybe a case where they don't actually produce it. It is considered, though,
their journal,
the link journal. And that may only be for the sciences group of it.
Okay.
Because Facets is also produced by the Canadian Science Publishing group. So there's a linkage there between those different groups. But CSP produces a bunch of journals like CJFAS and some others. But Facets is linked as the Royal Society Journal for Canada for, I believe, sciences.
Okay. And then last one in the list that I had in front of me will be the North American Lake Management Society produces Lake and Reservoir Management. But there are many others.
Yeah, AGU has 5 or 6 different journals at least. The American Geophysical Union, which gets a lot of paleolimnologists. So that is a common purpose for a scientific society. It may not be the only one. It may not even be the main one. But historically, it has been a very important one because it would be where you would collect all of the proceedings from the meetings that happened when scientists came together to discuss their findings and then put them into a record that could be published and then referred to.
And that kind of segues into another real purpose behind many of these societies and associations is be to conduct meetings. So to have the various membership come together, on an annual or biannual kind of basis to have, share their work with the membership. And some of the societies that we listed off earlier, like the meeting is largely the purpose of the group existing in the first place. So CCFFR would be an example of that.
Yeah, they are the meeting. That is their entire raison d'être. So much so that the membership is, there's no sort of membership fees to be paid. It is the registration for the conference, and the members are whoever went to the conference in that given year, which is very different from all of the other ones that I'm aware of. But for many, I would say, I don't know if you would agree, but I would say for most scientific societies, the meeting is the key thing that links people together and keeps it as a sort of the purpose of being a society. Journals, yes. I think, historically have been part of that, but it's become less common as many of them become published by large publication houses. They get folded into the publication fold of other groups. Not many societies continue to in-house publish their own journals, though there are exceptions, of course. And because of that, the meeting really is the key take-home reason for a lot of people continuing to be strongly linked to scientific society.
Yeah, and I, unless I have my history wrong, I think, you know, a key example of this would be the IPA, right? The meeting, the association basically grew out of the meetings and to provide institutional memory so that the meetings could keep on going and it'd be less of a seat of the pants operation of like having interested people driving forward, like, yes, we'll do this again in 3 years, whatever it is, and we promise. And then it was more a case of, okay, been doing this for a while, you know, there are difficulties associated with that. Let's formalize things. And that ends up becoming the association.
Yeah, to provide support for whoever the local organizers are, sometimes financial support, sometimes logistical support, often both, in passing resources from the previous meeting. Because often, we can talk about this in a minute, often good scientific meetings, and I don't mean good in terms of the quality of the science or the organizers, just sometimes just lucky, and depending on where they're even located, do make money. There is a surplus of funds at the end of the meeting if they're well-sponsored and they have a lot of attendees, more than they pay out. And for many of those societies, that money gets passed on to the next meeting, among other things. And having that executive knowledge at the association or society level to allow that transfer to occur, because oftentimes if a meeting's another 3 years away, the local organizers aren't going to have bank accounts and things like that set up in order to take that material when the last meeting closes. It gives that kind of transitionary period to ensure that everything transitions smoothly, even if it's just the meeting itself that's being kind of held together as part of the society.
Yeah, and kind of like jumped ahead of me a little bit here, but I was going to like tap into your experience here as a member of an executive of a society, as mentioned, Josh, as part of the executive of SCL. And, you know, just putting him in the hot seat for a second, like, I definitely, a question I was thinking to myself as a brand new graduate student is when, you know, membership fees come around, is like, why am I giving them money? Shouldn't they be giving me money to do this stuff? I'm broke.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And for SCL, I'm the secretary treasurer. So I'm literally the person asking for the money, or the person you'll send it to if you decide to join. And I think that's a really reasonable question. And it for someone who has been a member for 20 years, you know, they have that linkage to the society. They identify as members of whatever that is, SCL, AGU, INQUA, whatever it is. And for them, it's not kind of mentally hard to get over that hurdle that you should pay the $70 every 2 years or whatever it is to be a member. And they're probably in a position financially where that's easier. They likely have a full-time job. But for the new student, it may not seem so obvious. And I think it's still valuable. So one thing I would say is that, as far as I know, I've never seen a society that didn't have lower dues for the students. But it still can be a decent amount of money depending on what society it is. And the question of why should you give them money when maybe they should be giving me money, it may not be one or the other. A lot of times that money goes into student bursaries and travel and supporting students. So at SCL, that is in our incorporation documents, one of our mandates is to support students in both the graduate and the postdoctoral level with travel funds. So I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but you know, we of the money we bring in a year, I would say probably a third of it goes to student travel for the meeting in that year. And so that's a big part of what we do with our money. And not every society is the same. But a lot of them do have as a core mandate to support students. And that is far more than the student dues are going to be in a year. So that money is basically being transferred from, it's like crowdfunding from the more senior people in the society and being transferred to the students. But there are other reasons that scientific societies exist. It doesn't seem as popular maybe for some at the beginning of their career, but the mailing lists that are maintained by the society. So we have a website, every society has one, and there's a newsletter and mailing list is a good way to learn about things that are going on in the society. Good way to see job advertising. That's one of the things that we charge fairly small amounts for ads to academic institutions, but also consulting and government and all those different jobs. So there are a few smaller things that may kind of be sent out during a year that keep you connected to the society and to the members of the society. It's about, and sometimes bridging with different people that you may not know locally. Some societies, now we don't have this as ours, but some societies membership gives you a discount at the annual meeting or a discount on publication in the journal. So that's a fairly obvious one for the grad student that may not be coming out of pocket, but that's not always the case. So for inland, for SIL, you get as a member, you get access to inland waters and you get to publish for free as opposed to having to pay if you're not a member. So that's a few things. Any that I've missed that maybe you think of?
Not really. Like I was just thinking of, you know, my first time at the SCL meeting, walking past the membership table. And I think whoever was doing the pitch then is probably listening to the we'll probably listen to this show. And it wasn't a very detailed pitch, I don't think. It'd be just something of, I would have asked him like a smart ass, like, why should I be a member of SCL? And he probably said something to the effect of, just because, give me the money.
It wasn't for the merch, the branded merchandise, like the mugs and t-shirts and stuff.
No, or maybe it was, but I don't think I would have actually picked any of that. I have no SCL merchandise.
Oh, no. Well, I have a box of t-shirts here. I can send you one.
I like t-shirts.
And this is all from my perspective. So some other organizations may be very different. There are large organizations, massive scientific societies that have far more benefits that you can buy into. So like discounted insurance rates and those kind of things that come from the huge advocacy power that large groupings can provide. So there is a huge range from almost nothing in terms of tangible take-home money benefits through to very large ones. But in general, it's about being part of the community. And there are societies, including the International Paleo Association, that don't charge dues. And because of that, whether students were to get a discount on travel would be much more variable across different meeting years and would be entirely related to sponsorship and the cost at that location and those kind of things. So if there's bursaries for student travel, that would be not something that's sort of inherently guaranteed, not guaranteed in terms of that you're going to get it, but built into every meeting as we do.
It would fluctuate based on how well the last meeting went.
Exactly. It would fluctuate much more and really depend on the specific details. So there are trade-offs in that sense. And in general, I think the idea of having fairly low dues for students and early career members are is quite common. So for those Canadian paleolimnology students and others as well, you can visit our website and sign up. There you go.
Oh, which website?
Oh, it's
not the Core Ideas website.
No. You could probably find a link through there, through SOCANLimnol.ca, the Society of Canadian Limnology.
Plugging away.
Yep. I got to do it. So the one thing I might take a minute to talk about that we didn't talk a ton about, and it's not something I have a ton of experience with, but the role of advocacy in scientific society. So that can take a lot of forms, I think. And there's a little bit of history of that at SCL and other groups like that. So advocacy can be kind of continuous and ongoing and part of the, I don't want to say lobbying because it's not necessarily true lobbying, but the idea that they're pushing for different things. So many scientific societies have a really strong role in advocating for for government research funds being allocated to science. So that's a really important, wherever you are in the world, that's a really important thing for governments to continue to provide funding for science, obviously. And having groups of scientists come together with a single voice and a single mandate to try and improve that and make sure that that continues and hopefully grows is really, really important. And then there are other occasions.
Bouncing in there for a second. So this is where my political knowledge breaks down and whether or not what the equivalent term of lobbying is in Canada. I think, is that an American term where you're a registered lobbyist? I don't think you're a registered lobbyist.
I'm not sure we have a registration for our lobbyists, but we do have lobbying.
Yep. And you know, acting as a special interest group, you know, at what level can it occur? Like, can you call up Justin Trudeau and say, "Hey, I'm the Secretary Treasurer of the Society of Canadian Limnologists. I need a meeting."
I mean, as a Canadian citizen, I can call him up. I can be pretty certain that he would want not answer the phone, even were there not a pandemic in the world, and two, that meeting would not get scheduled. At other levels, there are the case. So again, we're a very Canadian example, but there's a group called PAGSI, which is a group of Canadian societies that are sort of together as a society, which is kind of
cool. A society of societies.
It's a society of societies. That's right. In science and engineering. So very broad, almost, you know, kind of akin to the Royal Society sort of style. But their goal really is to advocate for science. That is their reason for existing. And they host, and one of the ways they do that is they host these speaker events that are called the Bacon and Eggheads meetings. They occur in Ottawa on Parliament Hill or nearby. And they have really great attendance by policymakers, members of parliament, senators, all of those different people who may have very, very broad backgrounds, not necessarily in science. And they bring in really high quality academics on a range of topics, from, you know, astronauts to biologists to chemists, people who have won the Nobel Prize. I believe Art MacDonald, who's the most recent Canadian Nobel laureate, not the most recent anymore, apologies, Donna Strickland, won more recently than that. Both have given these talks order to advocate.
I know John Small has done.
He gave one well. Very recently. I believe Donna Strickland also gave one this year to this group. And that's a great, you get all these people together for breakfast, hence the bacon part. And, you know, you get to tell them about your science and why it's valuable, not just your work, but the work. And that's a really strong role for advocacy at a broad level.
Yeah.
The last thing I would say then is sometimes, you know, there are specific issues that have to be advocated for, and scientific societies put themselves in a good place for that. So not too long ago now, there was the kind of Canadian push to defund the Experimental Lakes area at the federal level, which caused a lot of consternation and headache for many, many people. And a whole range of societies did a lot of, including SEL, very heavily because the limnology connection was so strong, did a lot of letter writing and phone calling and that sort of thing around that issue. So that can be a case where a society that really isn't mandated.
Political arena.
Yeah, isn't really mandated in politics to be weighing heavily. We don't, you know, do that. That's not what SEL does generally. But at that moment, it was, because that's where we could use our voice as a collective.
And it's one of those things where, you know, because it's done so rarely, all of a sudden that message carries more weight. You know, it's like, you know, the nuclear option.
Yeah, I think so. I think there can be the realization that if you get scientists mad enough to march in the streets of Ottawa in large numbers, and organized meetings.
Plywood coffins.
Yeah, exactly.
And then one last question on keeping you on the hot seat before we kind of just go into more rambling kind of topics. We, in like the run-up to the show, we revealed that, or it came up, that you were a member of a large number more societies and groups than I am. I'm basically an SEL member, and that's about it. And there's no SEL-specific handshake that can get me out of speeding tickets or anything like that?
There is not, and that's the official word on that topic.
Okay. How about any of the other societies? Is there one you would recommend to join for speeding ticket purposes or no, other science purposes?
No, I haven't found it yet. I do like to collect things in general. It's sort of part of my hobby. Well, part of how I pick my hobbies, but not that I have found yet.
That is unfortunate. That'd be some great words of wisdom to share right now.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you keep joining things and let me know when you find a really good one.
Perfect. We'll do. We'll have a follow-up episode. Of course, it's audio, so I won't be able to show anyone the handshake, but Adam will see it.
A Twitter video.
Yeah, yeah. Perfect.
So yeah, so, you know, as we delve into personal anecdotes a little bit here. What was the first meeting or association meeting or society meeting that you attended that you can remember?
So we'll talk about the PALS meeting, which is sort of a not really a true society in a minute, but something that's very close to both of us, having organized PALS meetings before. And now I think about it, the 2009 SEL meeting is probably the first one that was a meeting specific to a whole society. So I'd been to other conferences. I went to like a Arctic Change meeting, but that was sort of run by ArcticNet, though a little broader than that, related to IPY kind of stuff. So that one in the late part of December 2008, an ArcticNet meeting, or 2009 SEL, which is only a few weeks later, would be the first meetings that I went to. How about you?
Okay. For me, it would have been, you know what, you got me thinking now. The first one I presented at would have been an ASLO meeting in Savannah, Georgia in 2005. But I might have gone to the SEL meeting that year earlier, just to see it. If it was a drive, this one I'm thinking of is in, it was in Windsor, maybe. Yeah. Then I would have like hopped in a car as a, fairly early on in my stuff to see stuff like that. But the first one I really presented at was an ASLO meeting. And then that was kind of interesting because, I guess I had dipped my waters in paleo at that point in time, but I definitely did not at all consider myself a paleolimnologist at that point. My master's had no paleo aspects to it whatsoever. And going to an ASL meeting and then, you know, just the size of it kind of being blown away by however many concurrent sessions there were and, you know, the amount of marine stuff that I just wasn't able to follow at all in many ways.
Yeah, I've never actually been to an ASLO meeting.
Yeah. I don't think I've been to one since, actually. I think That was the only one I've been to. But I remember, you know, just being struck by the number of talks on like marine jellyfish or and things like that.
Yeah, for sure. But I guess, what about the first paleo meeting then? The first International Paleo Limnology Symposium?
So the first would have been in 2006 in Duluth, Minnesota. And I would have gone, and that would have been, you know, maybe a month before I actually started my PhD. I basically, at that point, was making the transition to paleolimnology. You know, I guess I'd known I was going to be joining the lab for 8 months or so. And so I had, I don't have any, what did I present? I probably presented a poster. I'd have to go back and double check. But I think of some, like I worked for the Ministry of the Environment in like a technical kind of research position, basically doing what amounted to a pilot project for my PhD project. And so it was my meeting the lab kind of experience. And it, I had a lot of fun, and it was, and then it was very different as well. I guess this isn't necessarily where we're going to talk about it, but this totally fits in, is just the interest of, you know, ASL being massively broad in terms of, you know, limnology and marine. One of the things I really took away from my first IPA meeting was like when the focus is, you know, a tool set as opposed to a, I don't even know how you'd really talk about it, describe it, you know, or the application of the tools, I guess. And just seeing, you know, the breadth of talks. My interest has always been on fairly recent history. So like post-industrial effects, like acid rain, mining impacts, things like that, climate change. And then you're going in and seeing all these meetings and all these talks on like Holocene level stuff, and where they're talking about carbon dates for a large amount of the talk. And, you know, you kind of look at the slides and you realize it's like, whoa, each interval here is representing, you know, hundreds of years, you know,
and it's like your whole project.
And that's just like what would have been, you know, encapsulated in one slide in this talk. And then it just like, you know, leads kind of a little bit of imposter syndrome crept in. It's like, can I really qualify as a paleolimnologist? Like, A, I'm not going to do any of this stuff because it's just so alien in many ways. And you know, my, and it's not where my interests lie in many aspects of it. And it's just like, it was just weird in many ways. Whereas you kind of expect that in, on the ASLO when you go, okay, yes, I have no interest in, you know, the migration patterns of whatever marine mammal. But you expect it to be covered there. But the first paleo meeting kind of threw me for a loop a little bit in where you think it's going to be narrow, but it isn't.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting observation for sure. And then, so my first paleo meeting was the Guadalajara meeting in 2009, end of 2009, which was supposed to be a little bit earlier because of,
I remember that one well.
H1N1.
I remember several aspects of that one very well.
Yeah. No, it was a great meeting, including giving a talk while there was a mariachi band playing in the room next to mine, which was a new experience.
We were roommates for that meeting.
We were roommates for that meeting. That's right. That was a great meeting, actually. Yeah, I think that's a really good point, especially when you move to a new location. So moving to central, well, still North America, but further to the south, there was a lot of local paleolimnology there. So you get topics that are, or you get presentations that are really, really different, but all using the same method. And when you get out of the Canadian kind of North American, Northern European perspective, there's not that 10,000 year post-glacial historical perspective. So you can have really, really long records, as you would find from researchers working in Africa and other locations that don't have this glacial history. So you get a real broad sense of what paleo can do.
And you know, I'm not knocking or saying, but it was definitely eye-opening because I guess I went in thinking I knew what paleolimnology was, but then, you know, it was one of those things of like, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And then there's levels to the game of not knowing things.
So going back to Duluth, I think that was also a good segue, even though I added something in about Guadalajara, related to what this PALS thing we've talked about is. So for the listeners out there who are not sort of our close colleagues in Ontario and Quebec, this may not
and New Brunswick
now, yeah, who may not, this may not be as relevant, so feel free to sign up. That's okay.
It is relevant in terms of what we're talking about in terms of meetings, but we're scaling it way down to, you know, we've gone from international to national, and now we're talking about regional, and then even more so regional student society, student group within paleolimnology. And so the PALS is a graduate student run meeting focused on paleolimnology that is really, the official name is the Ontario Quebec Paleolimnology Symposium. So for our international listeners, Ontario and Quebec are two provinces within Canada, or I guess you think of them as states within Canada if you're not familiar with the political makeup of Canada. But anyway, so we're talking fairly small regionally, and
bigger than Europe, but
oh yeah, no, geographically bigger, but population wise, you know, attendance wise, we're talking meetings of like 50, 60 people.
One of the interesting things that was sort of identified is that in those two provinces, which geographically are huge, but population-wise are a good part of Canada, but not enormous, there is a whole bunch of laboratories at different universities with people who focus primarily on paleolimnological methods. So many so that we probably could have our own meeting.
Yeah. And this actually grew out of a, you know, beer session, pizza and beer session at Duluth, that I was kind of a fly on the wall at. But basically a couple of the professors, notably Roland Hall and Brent Wolfe at University of Waterloo, and I think Brent might have been very new at Laurier at that time, were basically leading a conversation with some other people around the table saying that, you know, IPA is awesome, you know, but for a master's student, you know, if you have a meeting of the International Association once every 3 years, a master's student could start and finish, in between those meetings and never get the opportunity to go to a paleolimnology focused meeting. And yes, going to the limnology meetings is great, like the SCLs and ASLOs and SILs is all great, but there's, you know, something a little different where, you know, you say the word sediment core and everyone knows exactly what you're talking about, or more specific than that, or, you know, what a, you know, a glue core, there has to be no preamble. Like, there's some value in meeting people in a room where everyone knows what you're talking about right off the get-go with no preamble.
Yeah. And it might be a good place to make liaisons, to join another lab if you're looking to go to do a different degree somewhere, you know, because you don't have to explain what your method kind of background is. You came there as a paleolimnologist in training, and you could easily transition between different groups. So a really good networking opportunity.
Yeah. And so they listed off just on a napkin all the people and professors regionally that would potentially be interested in attending such a meeting, and then go, you know, we got a decent size number here. And so the first PALS meeting, which basically is just it's not an acronym, I don't know what you call it, but it stands for Paleolimnology Symposium.
I always call it the Super Friends.
Yeah. It occurred in spring of 2007. And, Josh related some of his experiences on executive of a real society. My main interaction with meetings other than being an attendee was being part of the executive of this meeting, graduate student meeting that was held in Kingston at Queen's in 2010. And it's been going a while now, and got to see firsthand, you know, some of the purpose of these societies. We touched on it earlier, but like the importance of institutional memory and keeping things going. And, you know, like if it's a student run meeting, so it's not really much in the way of money, but in terms of, you know, when things like what is going on right now. So it's been, the PALS meeting's been running since 2007. There was not one in 2009 due to the swine flu. Like originally it was going to dodge the years of the IPA, but then IPA moved, so it didn't matter, but there still wasn't one in 2009.
Yeah. And then it was decided that there would still be meetings held in the years of the international meeting because not everyone attends every international meeting for a variety of reasons. So now after that, we decided to hold one every year.
Yeah. And there's a little bit of that gap of where you skip a year. It's like, you know, you lose some of the people that went to the previous meeting, especially when it's student run, depending on the lab, you know, some professors are more hands-on than others, but really it is totally student run. And, you know, there's a little bit of a fear if you skip a year, you know, like momentum is lost and what will you do? And, yeah, you know, there's been a couple of hiccups along the way.
There have, yeah. We were supposed to be at York a couple of years ago, and there was a big strike from some of the teaching fellows and graduate students. And so it quickly had to transition to the location it had been at the year before. So it moved back to Brock for a second year in a row, the only time it's been held twice in the same place in a row. And now we have...
And now, obviously, it was supposed to be held at... Mount Allison in New Brunswick, which is a third province within Canada. So we're extending.
Yeah, the first taking PALS on the road, and it didn't get to happen.
Didn't happen
this year.
Of coronavirus. So it's kind of funny. So it's, you know, I guess 12, 13 years, and you know, in that time, it's like effectively three cancellations due to unforeseen circumstances. So
you can see
the value of why these, you know, you'd have a society to make sure this keeps on going, but which isn't impossible in this student, or not impossible, but highly unlikely in like this kind of graduate student run thing. But just, you know, an example of, you know, the micro scale giving you some insights into the macro scale, really.
Yeah. It is one of those really, feel good kind of, things around PALS. It's definitely my favorite get together.
When was the last time you actually presented anything at PALS?
What's that?
When was the last time you actually presented something at PALS?
Oh my goodness, I don't know.
I think this might contribute to your enjoyment. Really.
Certainly not since I. Yeah, that is definitely true. certainly not since I finished my degree, and probably a couple of years before that. So probably 2011, maybe was the last one I presented it in London. Okay. But it's one of those weird things in that, like, Jenny, who we had on last week, would have been her first meeting too, because she was a new master's student. And now she's a faculty member and her students go to that. And Jesse Vermeer is a third, kind of second generation PALS organizer who has his own lab now and sends students to the meeting. And Josh Couric, and who is at Mount A, and would have held it this year. At least his students would have held it this year. So it is one of those interesting legacy and sort of memory things, and that'll continue to happen. And it's just a really good chance to get everyone together and really informal, which is the nice thing about it.
Yeah. Cause it's definitely, something to be said for your first, especially, you know, as a new master's student or even an undergraduate student in some cases, you know, your first presentation to be in a friendly room, because, you know, when you go to a big meeting in a big room full of, you know, quote unquote,
big names,
rock stars in some cases, it can be incredibly intimidating.
Yeah. Even if it's not actually, it definitely feels it.
Yeah. Like, and you know, part of it is being unfamiliar. Part of it is being a new experience. And another part is, you know, putting a lot of the audience members that you have read their papers on a pedestal, you know, without realizing they're people too, in many ways. And we're in that same spot.
And until you see them spill the whole coffee on themselves at the first break, they can seem pretty intimidating.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. I think that was a good dive into what is a scientific society. A few of the ones that might be familiar, at least in acronym, to some of our listeners, at least.
Yeah. And
We did have one correction that I saw, because Adam and I are looking at each other here. And even though you can't see us, you could see him just like basically banging his head into the keyboard. Would you like to set any records straight there, Adam?
Yes. I guess so. This would be the first. What's the word? Corrigium?
No, yeah. No, if it isn't done after the fact, I think it's still the same episode. So we don't have to make an addendum to it.
So as opposed to mistakes that Josh has made in the, or I guess he stands by his thing, where he just fights with people on Twitter. When I was referring earlier, we're talking about the Royal Society and Sir Isaac Newton being on a pound note that I vaguely remember because I didn't see it very often. I looked it up. I moved here to Canada when I was a kid. And funnily enough, it was the £1 note. And so I could say that I grew up in abject poverty and saw single pound notes very, very rarely. And it was more of a hey penny kind of guy, but that's not true. No, I'm going to blame it on, and now I'll look up the years and I'll be totally wrong again. But it would have been around in my memory, around the transition from paper £1 notes to the £1 coins around the same time. And that is why it was a rare note, not because it was incredibly valuable.
Perfect.
And something to be treasured.
Right.
For Isaac Newton's hair.
Exactly. So there we go. We've set the record straight on that one. And then the last thing that Adam hinted at there, a little, it's not really in the mailbag so much as an exchange on
Twitter. We got feedback.
We did get feedback though. Yeah.
People are listening.
Yes, that's awesome. Right. Not only that, I think this person was listening for a second time to that episode, because I'm pretty sure he listened to it when it first came out. Professor Roberto Quinlan, who's also at York University, but in a different department from me, made note that in the bioindicators episode, I made it seem that an indicator that you needed to use lots and lots of sediment for was not a valuable...
Five or six grams wet.
Yeah, 5 or 6 grams wet was not word. A valuable paleolimnological indicator. And I think him and... He was calling out for the whole coronamid community, though I don't think anyone else engaged with him on it.
Are you gonna walk that back, or are you going to double down?
I'll walk it back. As much as I like a good internet fight, I agree that there are some things, including some of the contaminant work that I've done, that just eat the sediment away and are very valuable. So I wasn't thinking about that. And so, Roberto, I apologize profusely to you and the entire coronamid community. You are very valuable, and you can use as much sediment as you so choose. And thanks for listening. Keep it up.
Yeah,
because I think you're half of our listens.
And if you have any comments that you would like to share with us and potentially get pushback from Josh about things that he would like to double down on in the future, you can reach us on Twitter at
Core Ideas Paleo.
And you can also send us email at coreideaspodcast@gmail.com. And our show notes and all our past episodes are available on our website at coreideas.ajezyorski.ca. And Ajezyorski is basically my name, but Ajezyorski. And until then, thank you for listening. And hopefully, you're better prepared for your days among the Illuminati after listening to this episode.
Sounds good. And we will catch you next time. So take care out there.